Everybody, welcome to episode 187 of The Rock Show. Can you believe that, Rob? 187?
Again,
getting close to 200, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
I thank the people for supporting the Van Halen show. Got a great response, and
right,
video is still going strong. And damn, the Jimmy Buffett one. Did I tell you that one will pick up?
Yeah, yeah. Started off a little slow and took off. So thank you for all the fans out there. We love you guys. Today's episode 187. And we're kind of continuing our little bit of 80s metal that we started with Van Halen. We're going to talk about Motley Crue today, the great Motley Crue. And it's going to be an interesting show, Rob, because it's going to be – we've had a few shows like this where we kind of shit on a band, okay?
Yeah.
And Motley Crue to me – and this is just me before we even get into it – they got two good albums, really, like the first two. Okay, but they have a very big fan base, and you know, that's just my opinion. They're one of the biggest bands of all time. So what do I know? But you know, I felt that, and Rob felt that we needed to cover them, and also there's quite a bit of history. I mean, they've been around for 40 years, a little bit more than that now, and basically everything started in 1981 for them, and they're still out there playing. I mean,
it's amazing.
It's selling out, you know. I mean, Vince Neil don't look like that no more.
Nah, he's like Vince Neil plus.
Vince Neil. He's huge. Yeah. All right. So you want to get into it, Rob? We'll start.
Yeah.
Right
now. You know, these guys really much came out of left field, but remember Tommy Lee, the scandal, all the girls who would go out and they were Pamela Anderson.
I mean, the Pamela Anderson sex tape. He was married to her.
And, yeah. And this guy also, the guy that killed the drummer from
Hanoi Rocks. Yeah. Yeah. Vince Neil, you know, was drunk and got Razzle killed. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could talk about that.
He got 30 days in jail and was crying like a little baby.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, if you think about it, you know, those lawyers, man, they must have been real shysters because they got him with 30 days community service and shit and all that. And that's it. Okay. Today he'd be in jail for like years for that.
Oh, yeah. You know? He'll
you couldn't get anybody off with that. Really what it was, and I'm just to talk about it for a second, is when you really read into it, they probably convinced the judge that by keeping him out, you know, out of jail and just making him pay a huge fine to the family, you know, all the stuff involved, he had to pay a big fine. Okay. He had to do that by touring. So they kept him out there touring so he could pay all these legal fees off. Okay. That's really all it was, I think. You know, that's the reason why he never got serious jail time.
That's incredible, man. That's incredible.
I could be wrong. That's just, you know, again, what I get out of it when I read about it. But
you know what? Were you thinking that?
Destroyed Hanoi Rocks, Rob. I mean, it totally did. Hanoi Rocks was a great band, and they were destroyed after that.
But I also think he only did 30, like he did like 30 days, like locked down 30 days, because he was like, how come you guys didn't come visit?
I think he served 18 out of 30 days.
That's what it was, 18 for
good behavior. Oh my God, he didn't do a full 30. You know? All right, so basically the nucleus of this group, Motley Crue, came together on January 17th, 1981, when bass player Nikki Sixx left the band he was in called London, and began rehearsing with drummer Tommy Lee and guitarist and vocalist Greg Leon. Okay. Now, Lee was earlier in a band with Leon called Sweet 19. And this trio, okay, this three-piece, rehearsed together for a time, but then Greg Leon decided to just move on. He wasn't interested. And then they got guitarist Robin Moore to come in. Now, Mick Mars was reading the paper one day, okay, and answered an advertisement that was placed in, it was a paper called The Recycler, which was kind of like a California, you know, want ads, okay, when they had stuff like that. And there was an advertisement placed for loud, rude, and aggressive guitar player wanted. So he answered the ad, okay, and he went down and he auditioned for Lee and Sixx, right? Nikki Sixx and Robin Moore. Okay. So he got hired on the spot. But then at the same time, they kicked Robin Moore out. Okay. So they went with Mars. Mars was an older guy, okay, than them. He was probably a good maybe 10 years or a little bit less than that, older than them. And he'd been around. Okay, he'd been on the LA scene in other bands going back to the 70s. Okay, so he was a well-respected guitar player. All right, and actually, just to throw it in there, is Mick Mars was always my favorite guy in the band. All right, I always thought he was the coolest guy. He kind of had a punk background a little bit that I appreciated. I saw him one time at a Ramones show at the Ritz.
Wow.
He was sitting up in the VIP section, okay? And everybody was pointing to him. Well, it's Mick Mars, you know?
But I also think he's the one that showcased the sound of this band. You know, I think he was, because he really had, like, the bad amps, and he was just playing it. It sounded like, oh, man.
But that's because he had the experience, all right? He was a talented guy. He was playing around for a lot longer than these other guys.
Oh, yeah. So,
they kick Robin Moore out. Mick Mars is in. And now they need a singer. Okay. So the new band at this time, they were auditioning several vocalists, but Tommy Lee knew a guy named Vince Neil. Okay. From their high school days. I think they went to the same high school, Charter Oak High School to be exact, in Covina, California. Now Lee saw Vince Neil in his band at the time called Rock Candy, and they were performing at the Starwood Club in Pasadena. We've talked about that place a couple of times. Lee suggested to Neil after a show one time that, you know, you should join our band, but Neil didn't want to. He refused. So lead vocalist they brought in briefly was a guy named Michael White, and he had played with Nikki Sixx in the band London. Okay. And just to mention, I think it was it Blackie Lawless or Chris Holmes from Wasp was in London. There's a connection there between London and Wasp.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Wow. We talked about that in the Wasp show.
Yeah. That's a while ago, man.
Yeah. It was a while ago. Now he had played with Nikki Sixx in the band London, but he ended up not staying with Motley Crue. They weren't even called that yet. They just had no name, and he didn't last. So Vince Neil's bandmates in Rock Candy kind of did a little turnaround on him, and they wanted to go new wave. Okay, they were more like a hard rock band.
Yeah.
And remember, this was the early 80s, so new wave stuff was making a lot of money. And
was Motley Crue still going under the name Sweet 19? What's that?
No. That was something that Lee had.
Okay.
A prior band. They really didn't have a name at this point. They weren't really. They were pretty much just getting it together. This is just a matter of a couple of months. They really didn't have a name yet.
Okay.
So Rock Candy decides to go New Wave. Vince Neil's not interested in this. So he gives Lee a call, and he wanted to try something new. So he said, let me call these guys. And on April 1st, 1981, he had joined the band, okay? And they play their first gig at the Starwood on April 24th, okay? So from between the 1st and the 24th of April of 81, they're practicing, and then they go get their first gig. Now, originally, Nikki Sixx wanted to call the band Christmas.
Awful name.
Awful.
Back to that.
I mean, it's terrible.
It's a new album by Christmas. It fucking sucks. That was a terrible name.
Yeah, it was a terrible name. So, and the guy said that was a terrible name. So they weren't too receptive to that. But then Mick Mars remembered an incident in an old band that he was in when somebody had said to that band at a show or something, "You guys are a bunch of motley looking crew." Okay, so it sounded good, so we'll call ourselves Motley Crue, all right? And what they did is they modified the spelling a little bit, and then they added the umlauts, which are the two dots on the O and the U, right? Yeah. And the reason they got that is because they were all sitting around drinking Löwenbräu. Okay, because Löwenbräu has the dots on it, you know?
Yeah.
So you could thank Löwenbräu for the Motley Crue name, you know? So the band then soon met their first manager. The guy's name was Alan Kaufman. He was the 38-year-old brother-in-law of Mick Mars's driver. Okay. Now, Motley Crue released its first single, Stick to Your Guns, with the song Toast of the Town on the B-side. That was on Kaufman's own label, Leather Records. Okay. Now, on November 10th, 1981, the band released their first album, called Too Fast for Love, on Leather Records. It was self-released on that label and also self-produced. It ended up selling 20,000 copies, which is pretty good for
an
independent label, you know, at the time. Now, Alan Kaufman's assistant...
Mike, that must have been like an independent label, right?
It was. Kaufman, the manager, had this label, a couple of bands on it. There wasn't much on it. And he just, instead of dealing with the majors, he wanted to put something out right away. He did it with them. You know, there's different routes you can go with a band. Okay. Some people try to hold out for a major contract, and some people take the attitude, well, we got to get something out there so the majors can hear it, you know, what we sound like on record.
Yeah, but think about it. The Zito Company sold 20,000 albums. That's a lot. Like, that's, to me, that sounds like you're a big time player.
Motley Crue, in a short time, okay, in a matter of maybe 5 months, okay, of existing and playing shows, had a huge following in LA. Okay, they were like the next up and coming thing. Okay, very fast, and the scene in LA was changing. It was going away from punk and new wave, okay, and into this like heavier, what would become hair metal, glam rock kind of stuff.
Glam rock, hair metal. That's pretty much. Are they originated? They're not the originators of that.
I would say they're up there. Okay. I'd have to give them that credit as an originator of hair metal. They wouldn't like. I don't think they like to be called hair metal. I mean, they were crazy with the outfits and the makeup and the hair and all teased out. You know, I mean, again, it goes back to.
I think they stole a little bit of that style from the New York Dolls
and Hanoi Rocks.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, Guns N' Roses, just a couple of years later, would totally take from Hanoi Rocks and even admit it. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, but Motley Crue, they were definitely, I mean, we know now Nikki Sixx talks about his punk influences and the New York Dolls, and many years later there would be, when the New York Dolls would reform, Motley Crue would go on tour with them.
Wow.
Okay, well, they would go on tour with Motley Crue and open up. Okay, so at the same time that this record is selling 20,000 copies, Kaufman's assistant, a guy named Eric Grief, he set up a Canadian tour, and he was also with Kaufman working on Elektra Records, negotiating a deal with them. And Elektra was very anxious to sign them because they were the next up and coming thing. And they had an album out already that sold 20,000 copies. So, you know, it wasn't hard to convince a major label like Elektra. So Elektra Records signs Motley Crue in early 1982. They have this album. They take the masters. They remix them. Okay. Give them a little bit different sound. And you could go on YouTube and hear the Leather Records version. And then you could listen to the Elektra. And there is a different sound. Okay. Just a different mix. But they released this on August 20th, 1982. And it basically coincided with the Canadian tour. Okay. It was cleverly named Cruising Through Canada. Cruising like C-R-U-E, sing through Canada. Tour 82. All right. So there were several. This tour was kind of legendary. There were several PR stunts that they pulled off. Okay. The first was the band got arrested at Edmonton International Airport in Canada. Okay. Their clothes that they were wearing on the plane were considered dangerous weapons. They were wearing stuff with spikes out of them. So they get arrested for that. Then Neil ends up getting arrested for having a small carry-on bag filled with porn magazines. Okay. Now in those days, you couldn't go through an airport with porn magazines. It was considered indecent material. So customs eventually confiscated everything and, you know, threw it out. But second, what they did is while playing at Scandal's Disco in Edmonton, a fake bomb threat was called in. Okay. And that made the front page of the Edmonton Journal on June 9th, 1982. Okay. And lastly, Tommy Lee threw a TV set out of an upper story window in a Sheraton hotel. Okay. In Edmonton, and got them banned from Edmonton for life. I think that still sticks, that band. I'm not sure. Okay. But now, unfortunately, you know, these guys, you know, they were all out with the pyrotechnics and the costumes and, you know, all that stuff. And the tour ended up being a financial failure for them. Okay. But it got them a lot of good press. So it was all worth it, I guess. You know?
I think that's what they aimed for. Let's get some really, let's fuck up this.
It was all staged. Bad press. It was, yeah, it was all staged, the arrest and everything. You know, it was just to bring some controversy and get their name out there, people talking about them.
The bad boys of America.
Right, exactly. In another country, you get arrested for having porn, you know, like it's perfect, you know?
Yeah. So
in 1983, the band would change management to Doug Thaler and Doc McGee. They fired Kaufman and Grief. Grief would later sue the band for damages, which would drag on for years. There would be a legal battle with him for years. Kaufman would later be sued by investors that he supposedly sold Motley Crue stock. It was bullshit. He was selling Motley Crue stock to people that wasn't real. Okay. And eventually he declared bankruptcy. I think he lost his house. Yeah, he was a real character, Kaufman.
Yeah.
So Too Fast for Love was the name of the album, with the memorable title track, and the leadoff song Livewire was originally recorded in 2 weeks while the band was extremely lumped up in the studio, which, gee, Motley Crue getting lumped up is nothing new. But
no.
The band's antics and you know, on stage and stuff were getting them a reputation of being extremely rowdy. Their performances at the US Festival, I should say, on May 29th, 1983. And also they were on MTV when it first came out, and, you know, it was helping the band immensely. MTV early on was helping them a lot. At the US Festival, I think Vince Neil was just totally shit-faced, if I remember right. Yeah. So their second album that they put out is called Shout at the Devil, and it was released on September 26th, 1983. This is the album that would be the mainstream breakthrough for that.
Yeah, this is a great album.
Yeah. Four times platinum. Okay. Fantastic selling album. It generated a lot of controversy for the title track and the imagery on the album because it kind of looks satanic. Okay. gave them a bit of a, yeah, gave them a bit of a, they used the pentagram and, you know, is that Nikki Sixx giving the, yeah, he's giving the horns on that album cover, right? Yeah, he's giving the devil horns. And it didn't help them with that image, whether they liked it or not, because they went on tour with Ozzy. Okay. And that was the Ozzy Bark at the Moon tour in 1984.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard stories about this tour, the antics that went on between the two bands and shit they were doing to each other, tricks playing on each other. And, you know, I could only imagine the debauchery backstage at an Ozzy and Motley Crue show in 1984. Okay.
You know, probably the amount of drugs.
I've known people that saw them during that tour and said, like, that's the best time, best shows they ever did.
Wow.
Was with that tour. Now, you know, their reputation was, I mean, for consuming alcohol and drugs, okay, it was starting to get to like a legendary level. You know, I guess if you're on tour with Ozzy in 1984, there's a competition going on there who can get more fucked up, right? So, unfortunately, this would come to a kind of a tragic end here in a way. December 8th, 1984, there's a party going on at Vince Neil's house. They're partying with Razzle from Hanoi Rocks. Hanoi Rocks was a glam band from Finland, okay, and from Scandinavia, and they're one of my favorite bands of all time. They were hanging out with them. It wasn't the whole Hanoi Rocks. It was just Razzle, I think, was at this party, and if I remember right. And they ran out of – they had to go for a liquor run, okay, and Vince Neil was driving what's called a Di Tommaso Pantera, which is a little tiny sports car. Okay. Yeah. They were partying. They said, let's go to the liquor store. Vince Neil's driving. He's totally lumped up. Okay. And they get into a head-on collision. And Razzle is killed. Okay. He was in the passenger seat. He was killed pretty much instantly. Neil gets charged with a DUI and vehicular manslaughter. He gets. Okay. So he was sentenced, so we talked about this in the beginning, 30 days in jail, only served 18 days, and then got sued for $2.5 million.
That's like nothing, man.
I know. It boggles the mind. Now, the short term got negotiated by the lawyers, and it enabled Neil to tour and pay the suit against him. Okay. I guess they figured he was worth too much money to lock him up, which I think is sad for the families and involved. And, you know, it's like, who cares what you're worth? But it's a shitty business. You know, I don't know. But what are you going to do? So this was a big thing. I remember this being on MTV News. And
yeah, it was like breaking news.
Breaking news. It was in the papers a little bit. And, you know, it was a story everybody was kind of following on the fringes of it. You didn't have the internet in those days, so you had to wait to hear about it. But they started working on a third record, okay? And that record would be Theater of Pain. And that was released on June 21st, 1985. This is the album with like Home Sweet Home on it and Smoking in the Boys Room. And, the album was dedicated to Razzle from Hanoi and it kind of began a glam rock era hair. That's really like, you know, their hair metal album, their first. Okay. Well, in that genre by 85, it was a thing. There was bands coming out looking like that, mostly out of California. You know, like I said, it was supported by the first single, Smoking in the Boys Room, which is an old Brownsville Station song.
Yeah.
Okay. And Home Sweet Home was another hit off it. It reached number 6 on Billboard album charts. And again, would go 4 times platinum like the last record. So the legal issues that Vince Neil at the time of the recording, and, you know, the worries he had about that. And then also the band was kind of not getting along.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol going on. And Motley Crue doesn't like this record. They kind of don't like this album. They consider it a disappointment. But let me tell you, man, fans at the time, I mean, they wouldn't. They ate it up. I mean, you couldn't get away from Motley Crue with that record. And I kind of tuned out with that. I was like, it's kind of lame.
My album was always Girls, Girls, Girls. I love
that's
that.
The one. Yeah, that comes up after. Yeah,
that was like, to me, that was the album that I rocked the most, that I was playing, you know, because it was it's like freshman year in high school, and you listen to Motley Crue, Girls, Girls, Girls. What else is better than that?
Let me just talk a little bit more about Theater of Pain, and we'll get into that, because I do have an opinion on that. So Motley Crue spent the next year touring that album, Theater of Pain, and in February 1986 in London, Nikki Sixx suffered a near-fatal heroin overdose. Okay, so they were even starting to get really lumped up. The person who sold it to him, the drugs, was partying with him and dumped his body in that was unconscious in the dumpster. Okay. The incident inspired Nikki Sixx to write the song Dancing on Glass for their next album, which is the one you just brought up called Girls, Girls, Girls.
Yeah.
Their fourth album, released on May 15th, 1987, and debuted at number two on the Billboard 200 chart. Okay. Now, Nicks has said that it probably would have debuted at number one, or it would have gotten to number one, except that there was some shenanigans going on with Whitney Houston's record label, okay? Which I don't know which one that was at the time. I don't remember who.
Might have been Dance with Somebody.
Yeah, I don't remember what label she was on, but they, you know, in those days, and I'm sure it still goes on, you throw some money around, you get your record played more than anybody, and it sells more, you know? So I'm sure that's what it was. But the band was on Girls, Girls, Girls. They took a different look. They were a little less glam and more like biker looking. They kind of were wearing vests and leather or denim and stuff like that. Personal and drug problems were really plaguing the band at this point, especially Nikki Sixx. And later that year, he suffered another heroin overdose at the end of the year in December. He was declared clinically dead in the ambulance, but was revived by a paramedic who happened to actually be a big Motley Crue fan, gave him two shots of adrenaline in his heart, and got him going again. Okay. And that was the song the incident that would inspire the song Kickstart My Heart on their next album, which is 1989.
That's great song. Like, you know what's another thing people don't give Motley Crue credit? They wrote a lot of their own shit, right? Like, they were writing.
Oh, yeah. Nikki Sixx wrote a lot of the songs. Other guys had input. Yeah, they did write their own stuff. The only thing that, and this is what I was going to say before, by the time Theater of Pain and Girls, Girls, Girls came out, I kind of tuned out with them. You know, I didn't mind the song. The song Girls, 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 and even, you know, Dr. Feelgood. I didn't mind it. It was okay. Yeah, it was heavy, at least. You know, it was heavy. But they were starting to come across to me as like very manufactured. When I was listening to it, just it did not gel together anymore. You know, when the first two records came out, they had kind of a Motorhead-ish kind of sound and a little bit of punk thrown in, and I dug it. But then they got into a more of a poppy metal-ish sound, and I just I didn't like it. I was like, these guys are just it's fake, you know. And Nikki Sixx, to me, is where I'm going to shit on him a little bit. Over the years, since the band's been around, especially in the last maybe 10 years, I'd say 10 years, maybe 15, they love to talk about their punk influences. Okay. Now, they never talked about that shit in the 80s when they were huge. Never. It was never brought up. Okay. Yeah. Nikki Sixx wrote a book. Okay. And, you know, he talks about how he wanted to be Johnny Thunders and he loved Johnny Thunders and the New York Dolls and all that stuff. Yeah. I don't doubt it. Okay. But it would have been nice. It would have been nice if he would have helped Johnny Thunders out in the 80s.
Yeah.
Okay. And by mentioning that, okay, they never did. They, I guess they were afraid, you know, they were afraid to talk about that stuff because it was still so out there and kind of like not in the mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of have a bone to pick with Motley Crue with that. Like, okay, maybe you were into that stuff, but why didn't you bring it up? At least Metallica always talked about how they love the Misfits.
Yeah.
Okay. And they were using the same kind of artwork and stuff and everything that the Misfits had with their stuff. And, you know, they talked about their influences. And so many people, I know so many people that maybe a little bit younger than me, that loved the Misfits because Metallica introduced it to them. You know, I wish Motley Crue had done that. It's just me. You know, I wish they had done that with some of these other bands that influenced them, and they didn't do anything for them.
You know what the problem was with
them? At least publicly that I know of.
I think the problem with them, they were too fucked up all the time, man. They were doing a lot of drugs. These guys were really fucked up, man.
That's true.
You know? Because didn't Nikki Sixx keep like a diary of his heroin?
The Heroin Diaries is a book. Yeah, I've never read the whole thing. I've looked at it.
Crazy. Imagine keeping a freaking diary about.
I think I don't know if it was this episode where he died and had the overdose and was in the hospital, gets his heart started again. I think he went out, like when he got released, he went out and got high again, like the same fucking day or the next day. You know, it's like, damn, but man.
He also told a weird story about like going to heaven and seeing some shit that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like an experience or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the book, The Dirt, is very good, which we'll go into soon. Everybody should read Netflix, that. Really, what?
Netflix did like a movie. Did you see that movie?
It was a book first. Yeah, I seen it. It's excellent. I think it was excellent. Yeah. Now, in 1988, controversy hit the band in the form of a lawsuit by a guy named Matthew Tripp. Okay, this is a strange story. Tripp claimed that he had been hired as Nikki Sixx's double. Okay, after Sixx was hospitalized in a car crash that was involving drugs. Now, the suit was regarding the loss of royalties that he felt he was owed by Motley Crue. And the case was not actually closed until 1993 when Tripp dropped all the charges and he kind of disappeared. Okay, but the band denied that happened and, you know, said that we don't owe this guy anything. Okay, he just came out of the blue with this lawsuit. So their decadent lifestyles actually almost destroyed the band around this point. Manager Thaler and McGee pulled an intervention on these guys, and it had to be done. So in 1988, Motley Crue was planning to tour Europe, but the management was afraid that these, you know, somebody's going to die over there if they go over there. Okay. So they ended up all agreeing to go to drug rehab, all right, and get themselves straight before they would go to Europe. Now, the result was pretty positive, okay, and Motley Crue would reach its peak in popularity with 1989's Dr. Feelgood, that album. That's their fifth studio album. It was recorded in Vancouver, California, and members, what they did, because they weren't even getting along too good, they actually recorded their parts separately, so they wouldn't fight in the studio, okay? And Bob Rock produced this album. And the hot songs off of it was a title track and the Nikki Sixx overdose-inspired Kickstart My Heart. And on October 14th, the album went to number one on Billboard. And it stayed a total of 114 weeks on the charts. That's pretty good.
I remember that album being number one. It just came. I thought it was a very well done album, even though I only like two songs out of it.
Yeah,
but it was a good album. Like you can listen to the whole album and not totally hate it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean it stands up. You know, that whole era up until this point is considered their peak. You know, their best stuff. The title track and then Kickstart My Heart actually were nominated for Grammys in the Best Hard Rock category over a two-year period, okay?
Yes.
In 90 and 91. Now, both years they ended up losing to Living Color, okay? But they did win an American Music Award in 1991 for best hard rock metal album, beating out Aerosmith's Pump album, which sucks. All right, so it's good good that they beat them out with that, you know? Not a big Pump fan by Aerosmith. So in 1989, manager McGee was fired because he was also representing Bon Jovi at the same time. And these guys were, you know, in competition for a lot of things, including chicks, I'm sure. Motley Crue was supposed to play the Moscow Peace Festival. It was a big deal. And Bon Jovi was playing it too. And McGee was managing both bands, and he gave the better time slot to Bon Jovi. Okay, and Motley Crue got pissed off at that and, you know, fired.
This time Bon Jovi might have been the bigger band, you know?
89? Yeah, possibly. Possibly. Well, they were definitely in competition with each other.
Yeah, you know? But they were definitely, I think, the more popular band. So you do got to give the most popular band
the better time slot. I mean, you know, I would agree with that. If I was in a band and another band was bigger than me, I'd be like, yeah, all right, nothing I could do about that. Okay. So I think just they had a problem with McGee representing both bands. So Thaler became the sole manager at that point. So they were touring constantly between 1989 and 1990, and they had a best-selling album, Dr. Feelgood. But things were starting to go south. They were really feeling burnt out, okay? Yeah. In April of 90, Tommy Lee suffered a concussion, all right? It was a mishap involving the drum kit that he was – he always had antics with his drum kits. It would always be – the kit would go out into the audience or it would flip around, and he'd be upside down. And, you know, there's all these, like, antics that they did on stage. And he ended up cracking his head open in New Haven, Connecticut, somehow in an accident playing drums. And he got a concussion. So in October 1991, they ended up, instead of recording a new record, they put out a compilation called Decade of Decadence, 81 through 91. And it peaked at number two, which is pretty, you know, pretty good for greatest hits.
Yeah, greatest hits. That doesn't happen too much. They go up there, but to be number two, that's pretty impressive. But it's probably the best song out of all the albums they had, and they had some pretty good albums that time span.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't remember if that was a double album. I think it might have been. It was definitely had a lot of songs on it. You know, it was their first compilation. I could be wrong. It could be a single album. I'm not sure, but I know it had all their hits and, you know, some other throw-ins. So the next 10 years for Motley Crue would be a big time of turmoil. By 91. Grunge music.
Yeah, Mike, it had 15 songs. It might have been.
Oh, it might have been probably a single record, just a single.
It might have been. It also might have been a CD at this time, right?
Yeah, could have been. 91, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely probably was a CD. Yep. Well, yeah, they were still making vinyl. You probably get both. You know, vinyl was starting to get phased out by then. But the music industry was changing by 91 as well. Okay. So bands like Nirvana and Soundgarden were taking up a lot of the airwaves.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much the demise of the hair metal scene. Okay. And, you know, in 1992, Vince Neil decided to leave the band in February of 92. To this day, it's unclear whether he was fired or quit. Okay, it depends on who you ask. he was replaced briefly by John Corabi, and the band released a self-titled album in 1994 with John Corabi as lead singer. Now, the album peaked at number seven, and it was considered pretty much a commercial failure. I don't know, peaking at seven is not bad, but it didn't go platinum, and I think that's why they considered it a failure. It didn't really resonate too well with Motley Crue fans. Everybody liked Vince Neil and like Corabi. He was different. He played guitar and he sounded different than Neil. And, you know, the band sounded different. Now, our good buddy, Dan Scott, okay, on the our good buddy shows up on the bar and hangs out with us. He actually saw Motley Crue with John Corabi. And he actually said, I like that album. He said it was different. He said they were writing more serious stuff. Okay. For instance, I think Corabi had a lot to do with that. There was a song that Corabi wrote on that album called Uncle Jack. And it's about Uncle Jack being a fucking kid toucher. Okay. And I think Corabi, I don't know if Corabi was touched by his, I don't know. Okay. But I think, you know, he wrote about this. And there's some lyrics in there, like, I don't know. I'm just going by what Dan said, something about wanting to, you know, cut his throat or something like that. Okay. So yeah, they were writing less songs about strippers and, you know, and drugs and being a little more, you know, serious. And some people like this record, but it really didn't resonate. So in 1997, Vince Neil would return to Motley Crue. All right. He had actually two solo records in the time that he was gone, 1993's Exposed and 1995 was called Carved in Stone, his second solo album. They didn't sell that good. They sold okay. Okay. It was obvious that the band and him, they needed each other
to really
be big. Rolling Stone magazine in late 96 was starting to hype the return of Vince Neil to the band. And when he finally did return, their current Motley Crue manager named Alan Kovac and Neil's personal manager named Bert Stein, they set up a meeting with the other guys in the band and all agreed to, what they said, leave their egos at the door and come together and make an album. Okay. So in 1997, they released the album Generation Swine, and it was their final record with Elektra. Debuted at number 4, and the band played live on the American Music Awards. I remember watching this. It was like the return of Motley Crue, the original band.
Yeah. You
know? So now, despite the hype of this, the album didn't sell that well. And that was due mostly for two reasons. The industry changed with grunge, okay?
And I don't think it was a good album, to tell you the truth.
No, it really wasn't that good. It was kind of slapped together, okay? Yeah. And Elektra wasn't backing them. It was their last record. It was obvious they were done with them.
Yeah, they're like, let's get these guys out of here. Let's do the final hurrah and make whatever we can.
Whatever we can and kick them out and not re-sign them. The writing they saw on the wall was, you know, this kind of shit's done. You know, we're not going to push this music.
Yeah.
So also all the craziness with the band. Okay. There was always fighting and this and that, a lot of drugs and stuff. So, interesting thing is Elektra gives them the boot, but also gives them all their music and master tapes and say, you got control over this. Now that never happens, hardly ever. Okay. You know, a band, if you leave their label, they still want to put out greatest hits and stuff. You know, they didn't even want to do that. Okay. So I don't know what the deal was, how they got that, but
I think they were just done. They were like, these guys are nuts.
Yeah. We don't even want to deal with them. So they ended up, you know, with all these master tapes, they ended up starting their own label called Motley Records, and they would immediately release a new greatest hits in 1998 with two new tracks on it, a song called Bitter Pill and a song called Enslaved. And then in 1999, they started releasing all the old albums, re-releasing them with Totally Remastered, with all kinds of liner notes in there and demos and different versions of songs and live stuff. Okay, was starting to come out. They also went on tour with veteran rockers, the Scorpions, too, which was a successful tour. In 99, Tommy Lee would leave the band. Okay, he wanted to pursue some solo projects. He had, he was declaring in the press, rock and roll is dead, and he's going to do rap. Okay, so he puts together a band called Methods of Mayhem in 2001, which I just laughed when I heard that. But okay, so do you remember when he had that band, Methods of Mayhem?
It was terrible.
Garbage. Awful. So he ended up getting replaced on drums by Aussie drummer Randy Castillo. And he would be featured on the new studio record called New Tattoo. And that was released right in the year 2000, right at the new millennium. However, before the ensuing tour, Castillo was struck with a bad ulcer, okay? And he would be replaced for the tour by Hole drummer Samantha Maloney for what was called the Maximum Rock Tour with Megadeth they were on tour with. While he concentrated on his health, though, he got stomach surgery for this ulcer. He ends up getting diagnosed with something called squamous cell carcinoma, okay, type of cancer. And they found a tumor in his jaw, okay? And he died on March 26, 2002. You know, Motley Crue at that point would go on hiatus and just kind of chill out, okay? So this is when they put the book together. 2001, The Dirt comes out. It's considered an autobiography because all the band members had a part in writing the book. It was helped by a guy named Neil Strauss. Basically, they depicted themselves as the most notorious rock and roll band out there. Okay, and it, you know, they had the facts to back it up, so I'm not going to doubt them. They were doing some crazy shit. Now, the book ended up on the New York Times bestseller list, and then a film adaptation was made on Netflix in 2019. In 2003, the band released two box sets called Music to Crash Your Car To, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Now,
what a name.
Now, the title for this, Michael Monroe from Hanoi Rocks, was livid. Okay. Like, how could they name this? Okay. When he killed our drummer. Okay. So, you know, Vince Neil, I think they just denied it had anything to do with Razzle, but really was a poor choice of title. So a promoter in England named Mags Revell in 2004 started trying to get a Motley Crue reunion together with all original members. After meeting with their management several times that year, Nikki Sixx announced that they were back together recording new music. And in December 2004, a reunion tour was announced at the Hollywood Palladium in which the band would show up driving a hearse. Kind of a cool PR stunt. The reunion tour began in San Juan, Puerto Rico on Valentine's Day 2005. A new compilation was released that month entitled Red, White, and Crew with three new tracks, a song called If I Die Tomorrow, another one called Sick Love Song, and then a cover of the Rolling Stones classic Street Fighting Man. The album peaked at number 6 and has since gone platinum. So very, very successful album. 2004, 2005, and 2006 included some side projects. They did a Hurricane Katrina charity, and then they were on the Root of All Evil tour, co-headlining with Aerosmith. An early attempt to make a film adaptation of The Dirt by MTV Films fell through. They were trying to get something going with MTV Films, and that didn't happen. In 2007, Nikki Sixx published his best-selling autobiography, The Heroin Diaries, A Year in the Life of a Shattered Rock Star. Interesting read, okay? I actually never read the whole thing. I've perused through it, but it's okay. Pretty interesting. I did read The Dirt, which
the Dirt was good.
Yeah. And basically this book, The Heroin Diaries, is pretty much over the band's tour for the Girls, Girls, Girls album. All right. And what, you know, the amount of drugs Nikki was consuming was insane. On June 11th, 2008, Motley Crue and their manager, Bert Stein, filed suit against each other. Stein was Vince Neil's personal manager also. And according to the band, rival manager Kovac served as the band's manager at one time. Both were arguing what was Stein's cut in all this, okay, and claimed he wasn't really entitled to anything. Stein claimed he was owed 1.875% of whatever the band made. So in July 2009, this would go on for a year, a settlement was reached out of court. Meanwhile, on June 17, 2008, a new studio album would come out called Saints of Los Angeles. Originally, the album was going to be called The Dirt, as it was loosely based on the band's autobiography.
Yeah.
But they ended up changing it, you know, back to Saints of Los Angeles. They felt it was better. And that was the name of one of the songs. It was put out by a label called 11-7 Music, and that was their ninth album, okay? And it basically, also 11-7 Music was distributing all their material at this point, too. The title track for the album had a throwback Motley Crue sound, okay? And iTunes picked it as their best song of 2008 in a rock category. It was also nominated for a Grammy that year in the Best Hard Rock category. The song was released in the music game series Rock Band and was sold briefly as an exclusive for the video game, okay? And it was the first time that anybody had really sold a single through a video game.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's where rock and roll has been for the last 15 years. I mean, people are selling these songs, even if it's old songs of theirs, to the video games. The songs get heard on the video games. The kids hear them. They like them. They buy the record. Or they're making money just from being in the video game. They get
you know who did that big time? Grand Theft Auto. They actually had real songs. And you had like a radio. You could go to a rock show. You could go to a classic rock. You could go to rap. So
you put what you want in there.
Which is pretty amazing to just hear songs that you'd be like, what the hell? It was great.
They actually were selling better at that point through the game than any traditional streaming sites that was starting to be out there. Okay, so it's crazy. From July 1st to August 31st of 2008, the band headlined the popular Crue Fest, which was a festival including opening acts Buck Cherry, Papa Roach, Trapped, and 6 AM, which was Nikki Sixx's side project. They then spent the fall and winter on tour with Hinder, Theory of a Dead Man, and The Last Vegas, okay, some other bands. Over the next few years, Motley Crue concentrated on touring. Some shows included the Ozfest in 2010 and the band's 30th anniversary tour in 2011. That was with Poison and special guests, the reformed New York Dolls. I mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
And again, shout out to Dan Scott. He saw them on that tour and he said the Dolls were great. You know, I remember seeing them at the, couple years earlier and they were pretty good when they came back. Also in 2012, a co-headlining tour with Kiss, and I saw Motley Crue and Kiss on that tour at the beach. And they began a Las Vegas residency tour in 2013. Seems like a lot of bands, older bands, are getting that now. Aerosmith had a residency. You know, a lot of older bands are playing Vegas. They're taking the Elvis route, I guess, right?
Definitely. And pay a few bucks.
Yep. Now, it was announced in 2014 that in 2015, Motley Crue would retire from touring. Nikki Sixx left the door open for releasing new music at times. One new track was called All Bad Things, and it got played over the loudspeakers at concerts before they would go on. The 2014-2015 was supposed to be their final tour. Now, on September 19, 2015, the band played Rock in Rio on the main stage, and then December 31st was the final Motley Crue show, supposed to be. Now, it was filmed as Motley Crue, The End, and got released on DVD in the following year. In 2017, though, Motley Crue frontman Vince Neil told Sammy Hagar on the show Rock and Roll Road Trip that the band was completely done. However, 1 year later in 2018, he would announce on Twitter that new songs were recorded for the release of the Netflix film The Dirt. And that's when you started hearing about this.
Yeah.
The film portrays the band's debauchery in the 1980s, and a soundtrack for the film was released at the same time, which included three new songs, including a version of Madonna's Like a Virgin, which is entertaining.
Yeah.
Okay. The soundtrack, produced by Dr. Feelgood's producer, Bob Rock, hit the top 10 on Billboard. Now, it was the first time in over a decade that the band reached that. Okay, that they went top 10.
And I also think a rock and roll album reached that, too.
Well, the soundtrack for the film. So it was kind of like a greatest hits. Now, in November of 2019, rumors started to circulate about a 2020 tour with Def Leppard and Poison. In December, the contract that the band had actually signed amongst themselves that they wouldn't tour, they had a reason to do that, okay, they burned it in like a PR stunt. They burned the contract on a video and sent it out as a press release. So a new tour in 2020 was announced. The tour was scheduled, but then rescheduled several times due to the COVID pandemic. Finally, in 2022, just last year, the tour commenced. And in October of 2022, guitarist Mick Mars decided to retire as a touring member of the band due to some health issues. He had some serious health issues going on. So remember, he's older than these guys too. Okay, Mick Mars is like 70 now. He's something like that, if not a little older. Right away, he was replaced by ex-Marilyn Manson guitarist John Five, and he would later be confirmed as a full band member in April of 2023. John Five would be. Now, in that same month, Mick Mars sued the band, okay, saying that they were trying to remove him. I think his intention was he just couldn't tour anymore. Maybe he would be a band member, okay, if they were going to record. And the band, you know, denied the charges, saying they were throwing him out, okay. But it looked like they were. I mean, they made John Five a member, okay. So, in April, it was announced that they were working with producer Bob Rock again on some new songs. But then they said that they would never work with Mick Mars again. So he was out. Okay. Nikki Sixx would later announce that the new album was in the mixing stage and that a new tour in 2024 is planned. So that's where we're at right now. Basically, Mick Mars is out. John Five is in. John Five is a good guitarist. I'll give him that.
Yeah, he is a good guitar player.
And, you know, he's a little bit of a younger guy. I think he might give them a kick in the ass that they need. I wish Motley Crue all the best. They're out there doing it, you know. Like I said, I kind of really only like the first two records, but that's just me. That's just me.
So I like the Girls Go and the Dr. Phil Good album to be one of my favorite albums. I like those first albums. Then after that, I have no clue what they did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that Generation Swine and stuff like that, that I remember hearing it, but it just went over my head. That was
a bag of dicks.
Yeah. This stuff you heard in the background, you know?
Yeah. It was like, you put it in the background. You don't even know. You just know it's Motley Crue. And then you're like, keep going, doing whatever you want. You know?
Hey, listen, you know, they've been around for 42 years now. That's pretty damn good. Okay. You know, they had some minor breakups and lineup changes, but you know, they're out there.
They're out there. You got to give it to them that it's still out there.
Yep.
So, Mike, thank you for another excellent research of this great band, Motley Crue. You know what? They were at that time, they were as good as any other band out there.
Yeah. I mean, at their peak. Okay. Yeah. You know, 88, 89, you know, they were out there kicking ass. And I always, just to throw it in there, I wasn't big on the hair metal stuff. I like some things.
Yeah. Okay.
But I always kind of felt they were a little different than that. You know, they had a harder edge. Okay. They weren't like Poison or.
Yeah. Like Poison.
Warrant or.
You know, have fucking Rat. Cinderella, you had a bunch of bag of dicks out there.
Yeah. I mean, Cinderella to me was just, at best, they sounded like AC/DC.
Yeah, they were trying to sound like AC/DC.
I know, you know, that always kind of bugged me. I'm like, well, they're just trying to sound like AC/DC. But Motley Crue had their own sound. Mick Mars, great guitar player. Sad that he's not in the band no more, which means I have absolutely no interest in seeing them because he was like my favorite one.
You know what the thing with the best one after all that? Skid Row to me was one of my favorite bands at that time.
I never liked Sebastian Bach, man. That guy.
Dude, that guy's a monster. That guy was doing Broadway. He was doing Jekyll and Hyde. The guy's fantastic. He's a great
You know what? I I don't know. Yeah, I was never a fan, but he's out there doing his thing. I like that. You know, he's acting now, right? You're saying?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty good. All right, Mike. So if people need to drop some lines, how can they find you?
If you want to find me, I'm all over. You could find me on Instagram, RockerMike212. You could also find me on Twitter, RockerMike212. I'm on Clout Hub, MeWe, Truth Social, Getter, all under Rocker Mike. And I'm most active on Facebook, but I can't be Rocker Mike because of Zuckerberg. So for some reason, they say it's not a real name. So I go by the name Rocko Mike. And of course, on Facebook, we have the Rock Show podcast group page. Check that out. Me and Rob are on there, and I'm always posting a song of the day and song of the night. Get into it. Pictures and all kinds of stuff every day we post.
And this is a big community, man. We got a lot of people in that community.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about 2,000 people. You know, it's not bad. You know, everybody, I love all the fans. If you're watching, I appreciate everything. Both of us do. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, we've been doing this now. It's going on in a couple months. It's going to be 5 years.
I can't believe it.
Listen, you know, it's a slow burn, but we've managed to get some notoriety a little bit and you know, and it's cool. You know, I love it and I love doing it. It's a lot of bands to talk about. We never have a shortage of bands.
You know, what's the comment I always get? That guy that works for you, the guy's a genius. He's a music genius, man. Everybody will say, that guy knows his stuff. He does his research. I always get good comment like that. And I'll be walking around, hey, Rob, another great rock show. And I'm like, what? What the hell are you talking about?
I mean, I've been in bars down in East Village, and you know, someone will just tap me on the shoulder. They hear me talking. They go, "Do you have a podcast? Are you Rocker Mike?" You know, I'm like, "Wow, you know, all right." So maybe I'm famous in a 3-square-block area. It's all cool. It's all cool. It's not going to my head.
All right, and people, if you want to find me on X. Instagram, Facebook, and the gettinglumpedup.com website. So
and we're both on that new Threads, right?
Yeah, Threads. We're also on Thread. Yeah,
I'm on there too as Rocker
Mike.
That's
like more like it's pretty much Twitter. It's just
Twitter, but Instagram. It's just their version of it's part of Instagram, right? It's their version of
it's connected with Instagram. It's fine. It's the same
thing. All right. Another format to fucking post shit on, you know. more work to do. All right.
All right, people. And remember, don't get drunk.
Get lumped up.
And we'll see you next week.
Take care, people. We'll be right back.
Thank you.